Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Okay, so I don't know why it feels fun. I'm not a native Texan, so I'm just going to throw that out there. We've been in Houston for 15 years. And when I talk to Texans, I feel like I have to say that we're neighbors, even though we're not really neighbors. Is that fair?
You know what? Texas is a big neighborhood. So yes, absolutely fair. And I would say if you've been in Houston 15 years, you're certainly not a native Texan, but you're a Texan by now.
Okay. Like I almost feel like, okay, Zach, are we going to start that way? Is that how we're going to start? I'm raising four Texans. That okay. is for sure.
But you won't claim it.
I will say, you know what? It's awful. I shouldn't even, why are we even starting this way? Cause I did that. I'm talking with someone from Austin. I will often say, I don't necessarily claim Houstonian. I will say I'm not a native Houstonian, but I think there's something about me that feels more comfortable saying Houstonian than Texan.
I could not understand that more. I mean, I'm like, so we have a joke here that, we say Austin really isn't Texas, but we can see Texas from here.
That's the best.
Yeah. So I so understand what you mean. I understand what you mean. But I also think that, like, as someone who's a lifelong Texan, born and raised here, there is a piece of being a Texan that is so much bigger than kind of the, like, right-wing MAGA, you know, like, caricature that exists for a lot of the rest of the country about Texans, that it really is kind of a big, beautiful, and incredibly diverse place. I mean, Houston's the most diverse city, I think, first or second most diverse city in America.
Yeah, that's right.
And so there's a lot more to Texas than meets the eye. In fact, one of my favorite stats about Texas is that there were more Kamala Harris voters in Texas than any state in America except California.
Wow.
Like more Kamala Harris voters here in Texas than any state except California.
That's super crazy. That is super crazy. I'm actually really glad you shared that with me because I feel a little bit better. Maybe I'll hold my almost Texan head a little prouder because of that. Here's the real funny thing before we get into the book. This is that you should know this for context of why I think that probably, because I am actually a native Oklahoman.
And a whole different thing. Yeah.
Doesn't that make so much sense now?
Because it does.
And because you spent some time in Dallas, I will say you don't know my hometown. I'm certain of it. But if you've ever driven north on I-35 past that Red River, you've driven through my hometown. So
what's it called?
It's called Ardmore, which is like
Ardmore.
This.
Ardmore. I've driven through Ardmore.
Of course, you've driven through it. You've never been to it because there's not really anything there to go to.
Sure.
Except for the restroom. Like you want to stop on I-35. Like that's your stop. But it's exactly dead center between on I-35 between Oklahoma City and Dallas.
Yeah.
So like 100 miles to Oklahoma City, 100 miles to Dallas. And so even still, like we have a magnet on our fridge from some like race my husband did or whatever. And of course, like everything else, it was in Houston. So it's like the whole magnet is shaped like Texas,
sure.
but there's space on the top. And that's like where the logo is, you know, or something like that. But I'm like, but that's Oklahoma. Like I only, so it's not like I have some sort of like, you know, I don't live there either, but there's like a little bit of sentimentality. Like it's not just this vacant space, Texas, like there's a state there, but.
I'll be honest with you. That makes a lot of sense. If I'd lived like, let's say like Oklahoma City, you know, if I'd spent the last 15 years in Oklahoma City, there is a 0% chance I would say I'm an Oklahoman you call yourself. So yes, I'm
Oklahoman.
I get it.
Yeah, no, that's right. But anyway, so here I am, a transplant to Texas. So I just feel like we're neighbors. So anyway,
well, it's good to be with you, neighbor. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. I had a really fun time reading your book. I won't go as far as to say it was triggering. It was almost triggering in some ways. But I would say it felt good to be in good company. This region, as we were just talking about, is there are some distinctives about this region. My hometown, we used to call ourselves in Oklahoma the buckle of the Bible Belt. I've argued with people about where that actually is, especially other Texans. But it is a very interesting place. It is not, as you described, necessarily like only right-wing MAGA, all of this kind of thing. It is quite diverse. But religiously, I have found it to be a very interesting space. A lot of those things you talk about in the book in your own Southern Baptist upbringing, my upbringing was also Southern Baptist. And I will just say, especially in your chapter on women and kind of how your wife had grown up in some of these spaces where it's just like this is kind of a given, that women aren't, or women don't, or women can't. And I think that religiously, but also, socially and culturally, some of those religious things kind of get in the water. They
For
they're
sure.
in the streams here. And so it was really good to read about this. I would say including one of those things is this undercurrent in the book, this thread that I really want to talk about is kind of rightness of like, yeah, we got this. And that's a tough space to navigate culturally. So I just really appreciated all of that. I feel like I need to stop now. And give you
Well,
and
thank
give you
you.
a
I just want
second.
to say thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for reading it. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for allowing yourself to engage with both the hard parts and hopefully some of the beautiful parts too. Because it is, I think when we tell vulnerable stories and we tell real stories, they always have the chance to be both difficult and beautiful. So yeah, thanks for just opening yourself up to that.
Yeah, so I'll say the name of the book because where I really want to start is kind of in the subtitle, maybe. So it's called Better Ways to Read the Bible: Transforming a Weapon of Harm into a Tool of Healing. And I want to talk about the first part of that subtitle in the Bible as a weapon. One of the notes that I wrote was from the David Dark quote at one of the beginnings of the one of the chapters about religion not tolerating questions. And I, mentioned that before. When I started this podcast, it really was out of some of this evolution that I was experiencing, where I had grown up in a culture that you are familiar with. I read about it. It's a very similar culture to what I grew up in, which is, and I have framed it like this for myself. It was very important to have the right answers. And so you like maybe could ask questions, but really the most important thing was having the right answers. And so when I started this podcast, even a little bit before that, when I went to seminary and all of that, it was like I was asking myself a question. And the question was this: what if? Like, what if this whole faith thing isn't necessarily about having all of the right answers? What if it's about asking better questions? And I have been wrestling with some form of that question for the last several years now. And so when I read this book of yours, I was like, oh yeah, there's a whole lot of me out there. There's a whole lot of people like me who are kind of wrestling with the same kind of thing. And included in that is the Bible being utilized in a way that is harmful, not just to say what's right and what's wrong, but really affecting people's lives. So I'm wondering if you can just maybe start there with, like, because that's some pretty strong language, transforming a weapon of harm. That weapon of harm feels strong, but I think it feels appropriate.
It's funny. I did a podcast with kind of a more conservative centrist-ish theologian, and he actually had a real problem with the subtitle. He's like, it seems like you're calling the Bible itself a weapon of harm. And my response was, some of this is published marketing and stuff like that, right? So it can't be like transforming something that is sometimes a weapon of harm into, that doesn't, that gets rejected
Not
by the
a real big
publisher.
ring to it, yeah.
But I think the idea that the Bible has been used as a weapon of harm is irrefutable. I mean, it's historical and it's personal to me and to you and to so many other people. Like, it lives in our body and our bones, and the wounds that we carry, many of them were inflicted by somebody wielding the Bible like a weapon. And there are many, many ways that this is done. That's kind of what the first half of the book is about, with these harmful lenses. These are things that are often used by people who are attempting to wield the Bible like a weapon. And then I tell a bunch of stories in the book, which I know you know, just and they're all, real stories, people that are dear friends or church members, who have experienced that weaponization. And so the Bible is so often weaponized, especially in more fundamentalist type spaces. And so I like to think of fundamentalism as like a big box with really stiff barriers as the kind of four edges of the box, right? And if you start asking questions about life outside the box, or God forbid you take a half step outside the box, you have to be brought back in or fully expelled, right? There's no liminal space allowed in fundamentalism. You cannot ask kind of really open, big questions. You cannot explore outside of it, or fundamentalism falls apart. And so the Bible is really used like a, like I think about it like a police baton, right? When somebody gets too close to the barricade, like, they get batoned, so they go back where they're quote unquote supposed to be. That's how the Bible's used in fundamentalist spaces, to keep you away from the edges, is to say, oh, no, don't get too close. Don't ask that question. Don't investigate that. Don't read that book. Don't go to that church. Don't be friends with that kind of person. And the Bible, again, is used like that baton to keep you inside of that fundamentalist box. Because, again, if you step out, everything inside of the kind of fundamentalist framework of Christianity falls apart.
Yeah, I resonate with that quite a bit, and I think that it's the right answers to the right questions, and interpersonally, there is a whole lot of who's in and who's out. So as you mentioned, you if you start to tread on the borderlines, if you start to tread on those liminal spaces, even with asking questions, it's either you're gone or we need to rein you in. And that, yeah, anyway, that just becomes a very, very difficult place to navigate. I think as insiders and as outsiders in that space, it is
Absolutely.
very difficult to navigate. One of the things that you talk quite a bit about, and it's not on my notes, but here we are in this conversation, is you have a lot of statistics in the book, which I also really appreciated. And because not because people are numbers, but because they illuminate our situations oftentimes. And there were a lot of statistics you had about people leaving churches, categories of people who have left, categories of people who want to come back, categories of people who are like, no, thank you. This is not for me. And yeah, I'm wondering, as we talk about that, not only in terms of fundamentalism, but there are a lot of things going on there. And I think I'm kind of wondering, what about exploring the liminal spaces maybe helps with a more welcoming environment? I mean, this is maybe as an author, but also as a pastor, what have you seen where maybe some of those edges aren't quite as stiff? How does that help in providing a welcoming space for folks who have those questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. I make a statement in the book that, so many people are fleeing the church, something like 40 million in the last 25 years in America. And they're doing so for a myriad of reasons, but a lot of them are doing so because the version of Christianity that they have found inside of these church spaces has very little to do with the Christ that they've been talked about. It's this kind of Christless Christianity. A lot of other ones are also leaving because when they tried to push back against the things that they saw that were wrong, or simply just ask some questions about it. As I said, that they get pushed out. And so I've got a 10 and a 6-year-old, two kids, and I know you've got kids as well. When I'm talking with parents, you know, kind of advising them on, you know, I get some of that as a pastor, right? Like, what do I do with this situation with my kiddo? And a lot of ones that I get are about like, my kid's asking some crazy questions, you know, some difficult questions about life and God and theology and things like that. And a lot of us were brought up in spaces where our parents, you know, shut some of those questions down and just were like, hey, don't ask those, you know. And my response to people is the questions don't go away when we shut them down. You know, we just ask them somewhere else, right? And so I would say the same thing is true for people asking questions in churches. If you're not allowing people to ask those questions, if you are not attempting to engage with responses in good faith, it's not like the questions go away. They go and ask them other places. They ask them a lot in online spaces. They ask them to friends and all kinds of stuff. And so what you're ending up doing a lot of times is actually like driving people away because you won't allow them to ask these questions. You won't be curious with them, you know? And I think what a lot of people have experienced, I know at our church and a lot of other spaces, is that to flip the fundamentalism metaphor a little bit from the box to like a basement, you know, where you're kind of told when you're inside of the basement, like, this is all that there is. Like, this is Christianity. Anything outside of this is no longer Christianity. And it's like dark and damp and you're like, okay, well, I guess this is just it though. But someday you wander up the stairs and you open that door and you walk out into this big, spacious, beautiful house with a ton of rooms, and you realize that Christianity is so much bigger and more beautiful than you could ever have imagined. For the last 2,000 years, that there have been branches of faith and Christianity that have done some really incredible things, you know? And that's, again, why the edges of fundamentalism are policed so hard. That's why the questions are not allowed, because once you open that door, once you step over that barrier, most people have found that other spaces are just a lot more welcoming, a lot more open to questions, and, yeah, just a lot more receptive to actually meeting people where they are. And so if we want to stem the tide of people rapidly leaving the church, then we need to do a whole lot less shutting down questions, shaming doubters, condemning deconstruction, and a whole lot more of walking with people as they journey through faith and life and just meeting them wherever they are.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have a couple of things are going through my head. One of them is a quote that lives rent-free in my head. I hope it continues to live rent-free in my head. But when I was getting my MDiv at Fuller, I had a really incredible professor, Old Testament scholar, British, and he was lecturing, and he said something like this. He said, he quoted another Fuller professor from my seminary, and he said, he was wrong. And he said, and you want to know what? You are too. And then he said, and so am I. He said, theologically speaking, he was saying, all of us are wrong.
Yeah.
About 10% of the time. The problem is none of us know which 10%.
Yeah. That's so
now,
good.
I would say for me, I feel like the percentage is a lot higher than 10. Like, I'm feeling like 40 or 60 might be more accurate. But it was that none of us know which 10%, you know? And I think that that's, I've heard another author, and I don't know if it was hers or if she borrowed it, but Beck McNeil talks about certainty worship, you know? And I think that that's something that is present in so many of these spaces, is this worship of certainty. But according to John Golden Gate, it's like, none of us know which 10%, you know? And so what do you do when none of us know which 10%? The other thing to talk about, your big, beautiful rooms, you talk about this in the lenses that, that harm some. And so I really want to get to those specific lenses. But one of the things that it was very, that was like common in all of them, and you talked about it some, is like some of these lenses that are harmful, and you know, literalism, apocalypse, moralism, hierarchy, many of those, at least how we experience them in the US, especially in evangelical or evangelical adjacent spaces, come from traditions and doctrines that are very young. And that
yeah.
is wild because it's like, well, it's older than me, so it feels like it's brand new. And it's like, well, yeah, but if it was in the 70s, it's older than me. So come on, you know, like I know my kids like to say I was born in the late 1900s, which I was, but I'm like, I'm not like an old person. And some of these doctrines
right.
are just like a little older than me. But when you were talking about the big, beautiful rooms, I was thinking about, like you said, Christianity over 2,000 years. And so it's like when we're doing this, like really, sometimes it's a beautiful, but sometimes it feels like this tightrope dance of interpretation. Like we've got our current community, but we also have a history of 2,000 years of people who have been doing their best, sometimes doing their worst, but doing their best to interpret these texts. And a lot of these harmful lenses, especially that we see the effects of them in the US today, are just like super young versions of this interpretation. So I'm eager to hear you talk about that. Maybe it would be helpful to talk about the concept of lenses first.
Sure.
And then maybe kind of talk about like we'll go into the harmful ones and then the healing ones.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the main theses of the book is that we are all doing interpretation every time we read the Bible, that none of us are just reading it. We're not reading it in black and white. You know, it's not God says it, I believe it, that settles it. A lot of the things that we heard in, you know, evangelical or evangelical adjacent spaces, like you said, that's not true. We all have social locations. We all have experiences, backgrounds, beliefs, biases that we bring to the text. And not only that, I mean, the text is, we are not the main audience of the text, right? The Bible is not a singular book. It is a collection of writings by a collection of authors to a collection of audiences. And we are none of the audiences. So
that's right. That's
at
right.
Best, we are reading the Bible over the shoulders of the original audience. And it's wild to think that not only is that true, that we're reading the Bible over the shoulder of the original audience, but that even the original audience has debated interpretations, right?
100%.
And so I think we have to get to a place where we say, okay, we are all interpreting. Now, the question becomes, how are we interpreting? What criteria are we using to make interpretive decisions? Easy example, right, is when we're reading the Bible, we are constantly either overtly or kind of subliminally asking, is this descriptive of an event that happened, or is it prescriptive for all time, you know? And so your kind of typical biblical literalist kind of, you know, wooden reader of the Bible would say, well, it's all prescriptive, you know? And then I always ask them, you know, do you greet other people at your church with a holy kiss? Because that's what Paul says to do. He says, greet everybody with a holy kiss. And they'll say, well, no, that was cultural. And I was like, okay, well, if that's cultural, then couldn't some other things be cultural too, right? And so we're all doing this. And I think it starts with admitting that. And then my next piece of the thesis is to say, there are better ways of doing this than a lot of the ones we've been handed. Or another way to say it is that there are sometimes very harmful criteria that we use for biblical interpretation and juxtaposed to some much more helpful ones. So I identify these four most common harmful lenses for biblical interpretation that a lot of us were handed and that we might read through without even really knowing it. And then how do we identify and kind of discard those or at least develop an awareness of them? And then how do we then learn and implement healthier lenses? And to your point about the age of some of these lenses, the harmful ones, is so well said. And I could talk about the doctrine of inerrancy. I talk about that quite a bit in the book, about how young it is that it really is not written down and codified until 1978. It was really in reaction to a bunch of other things and incredibly problematic in so many different ways. But honestly, one of my favorite ones is that, depending on your kind of, theological stream that you grew up in, denominational connection, most of us grew up with something that in the book I call left behind theology, which is this way of understanding the return of Christ and heaven and hell and the end times and all of that. And that it is not only very new, like from the about 1830s, but it was really invented by this one guy named John Nelson Darby, and that there's a pretty compelling case that he didn't actually invent it, that he stole it from a teenage girl in rural Scotland who was prophesying at a tent meeting, and that he heard it and was like, that sounds right. And then he, started writing about it, and then it gets picked up by, like Jerry Falwell and Billy Graham, Hal Lindsey writes the late great Planet Earth, and then Left Behind, the massive empire bursts onto the scene using this very specific theology, this dispensational, premillennial, pre-tribulational eschatology. But again, let's just call it Left Behind theology for now. That not only is it young, but it was really like just kind of invented by this one or maybe two people, depending on if you believe the story about the teenage girl in Scotland. And that now it is by far the prevailing understanding of the end of the world and Jesus' return and revelation and heaven and hell. Okay, and then one more thing. Not only is that true, and not only has that done so much damage, especially for children who are exposed to these horrific pictures of Jesus coming back and, killing all of his enemies and, just wild stuff. But it's pretty hard to overstate how much this garbage theology has influenced American foreign policy over the last 100 years.
I mean, can we do a part two on that? Because
It's,
I'm
we
game.
totally
This is
should. It is
wild, right?
so wild. And the last thing I'll say is, because the lens that the kind of you know the yeah the lens for interpreting the Bible that the apocalypse lens gives us is, it essentially culminates with, like I said, Jesus returning, doing horrific violence to all of his enemies until, he has won the war, whatever. If that's your understanding of who God is, that God is someone who at some point will return and kill, murder absolutely everyone who dares to disagree, that makes it a lot easier to justify violence against anyone who disagrees with you, you know? Makes it a lot easier to justify war. It makes it a lot easier to justify really any kind of dehumanization and oppression. Because if your God's going to do that eventually, then why wouldn't you start now?
Oh my goodness. I have like so many things to say about this left behind theology. Number one, just for the record, it is way older than me. 1830s. But I was one of the kids though in youth group who was like severely traumatized by this. I mean, this was Thief in the Night movie. That's older than you, but I had to watch it in youth group, or it was presented to me in youth group. Left Behind book series, I started it and like literally the nightmares made me stop. I was like, I cannot do it. I was having nightmares that I was left behind. Lots of talk about heads getting cut off. Can I just say, like, there's lots of
So
decapitations.
much decapitation,
So many decapitations in Left Behind. And it is just in this whole Left Behind theology, this is it's just it's weird. It is very weird. But to your point, I mean, foreign policy, whoo, like that really can be a whole nother conversation. But also, I just want to point out, it's one of the frustrating things, I think. This was my life. This was really how I grew up. And what feels frustrating, just to point out, kind of, so take your Holy Kiss situation for a second. And then we're like, okay, like everything's literal. I mean, and these are the same groups of people, same people, right? All of these lenses that you mention.
And then you're like, okay, everything's like super literal. So this is a sin. This is not okay. This really happened. And no, I don't greet my church-going people with a holy kiss. And Russia really is the thing. Like, no, Russia's not mentioned my name. And well, it's the, but you see, it's the helicopters. And that's what happened. You're like, okay, Hal, like this is none of this. But you also want it, but you read it literally. So is it helicopters or is it birds? And we really don't
Right.
know. But in this case, no, I'm telling you it's helicopter. Does it say helicopters? Is it, well, no, but that, and you're like, okay, like
Yep.
make that make sense. Because all of these things, like I think that has been, if you catch me on a bad day, which maybe apparently you have, I think my like frustration with all of this is like, you don't get to have it all of the ways though.
No, I totally agree. And it's an incredibly salient point that nobody actually does this. That what ends up happening is that people take the parts literally that they like, and they take the parts figuratively that they don't like. And I'm saying this to all of us, that I think we have to try to do the work to make sure we're not just, like remaking everything with our own ideologies and stuff, that we should be challenged and transformed and all of that stuff. I would say I've developed a lot of grace. I've tried to develop a lot of grace and empathy for Sunday school teachers, adults and stuff in my life who gave these things to me, in full earnestness. You know what I mean? Like they believed it, and that's why they told me about it. They were legitimately worried that I was going to get decapitated, or that I was going to get left behind. They didn't want me to be left behind. Like, this sweet, I'm like picturing in my mind, like this sweet 80-year-old second grade Sunday school teacher who talked, I swear she talked about hell every single Sunday, because that lady was freaking terrified that
That's
her
right.
little second graders were going to end up burning forever in eternal conscious torment. And I have got so much grace for her, so much grace for her. I get incredibly angry at the people who know better. The people who see the inconsistencies and just double down, the people who have the training, who have the knowledge, who've been exposed more broadly, and choose to continue perpetuating this horrible, harmful theology because it helps them stay in power or make money or whatever. And I am trusting God's forgiveness for them too. But I'm still pretty angry about it.
Well, yeah, I think so. And but I also think, like, when I think about, I think we all had an 80-year-old second grade Sunday school teacher in the SBC. I think about mine. And I think that too, one of the differences for me, and I appreciate you saying that because it really is. It is like, it is just like grace all around. One of the phrases that I try to live by when I get frustrated, both with myself and with other people, is like, we're all doing the best we can with what we have, and like I really believe that of most of us, like
Most of us,
we are really doing the best we can with what we have. And sometimes what we have is meager, and I speak
Absolutely.
for myself in that situation. But I do think about, I think about her. I think about the Sunday school teachers who answered my questions and to the best of their ability and encouraged more questions. I was really grateful for that. And terrified that we would spend eternity in conscious torment, and wanting to pull us toward Jesus. Versus, though, I think with some of these lenses, there are the folks it's very difficult to watch. And this is one of those things, it's like when people are leaving, it's like maybe there was a fear at one point. I don't really know the motivation, but like, and then instead of like really earnestly trying to pull people towards Jesus, it is like Jesus hates you. He's mad at you. He's, like, and that feels, that is just awful. I mean, and I think even, I don't know, personality wise, even being in some of those spaces sometimes can just lend itself toward that. I think I thought that for a long time. And so during the pandemic, I think it was during the pandemic, we had a sign in our front yard that I just had made up at one of the local sign places. And on one side it said, God is love, and it had a little almost cartoon heart. And the other side it said, God isn't mad at you.
Ooh, I love that.
And And I actually got, we got a few, not many, but like a few notes in the mailbox that were just like, thank you, you know, for that. And then I had one neighbor who said, why do you have that sign in your yard? And I was like, I don't know. I think maybe people sometimes, I know I think this is what I said. I said, sometimes I need to hear that God isn't mad at me. So I thought maybe if I need to hear it, maybe I'm not the only one. And she was kind of like, I don't know about that. And I was like, okay, well, he loves you, you know, like whatever. But you know, I do think even sometimes these theologies communicate instead of like, I'm scared, I want you to come here, and this is the way I know how to do it. Sometimes they communicate, God is just like mad at you. And like you said, like if you think Jesus is gonna come, he's gonna kill everybody. Whoa, that's hard.
Absolutely.
You know, like, is God mad at you? I hope not. Because if God's mad at me, there's not really, I don't feel a lot of hope for anything if God's mad at me.
I totally agree.
Anyway, I don't know. We talked a little bit about some of these. I want you to talk about hierarchy for a minute in this lens. I was very appreciative to see that named as a lens. It probably is not one of the ones I would have picked off the top of my head, but when I saw it, I was very grateful for it. I would say we could go everywhere from the documentary about the dude that has the umbrella, you know, like I don't even think you mentioned that, but that's one. You know, like a lot of authority talk. But just kind of to in general, like kind of what's allowed and what's not allowed and who's allowed to be in charge and who's not allowed to be in charge. And so I want you to talk about hierarchy as a lens, if you will, because that it felt weird at first, and then I was like, oh yeah, no, I'm totally on board.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. The hierarchy lens is essentially the leveraging of scripture to prop up power structures which elevate some and diminish others. And then it's usually based on these intrinsic characteristics about us. So gender, race, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, things like that, right? So some people are closer to God than others. Some people are more qualified to be in charge than others. Some people are smarter than others. And then sometimes this goes together with like pseudoscience, or politics or things like that. There is a not insignificant portion of the population, especially a portion of the powerful in the population, who their main engagement with scripture is an attempt to baptize or give divine credence to whatever it is that keeps them in power or lines their pocketbooks, And so you see something like I talk a little bit about the curse of Ham in the book, and it's this really bizarre story that some people don't even know at this point, but it's this wild story where Noah, like after the ark and stuff, he gets drunk and he falls asleep naked, and his son Ham walks in and he's like, oh my gosh, dad's drunk and naked. He goes and gets his brothers come in. And they actually don't look at their dad. They back up and put a blanket over him, whatever. Noah wakes up and he's like super pissed that Ham saw him naked, even though it's like completely his fault. And so he curses Ham and he basically says Ham is going to be now, and all of his people forever and ever are going to be subject to the other brothers. They're going to be servants of the other brothers. And it's this really wild text that actually, is I don't think the story is even probably true, but the purpose of it is to tell essentially why it was okay for them to wipe out the Canaanites. Like that's really like the purpose of these other pagan nations. There's like, look, they've been cursed by God from the beginning. Who cares if we wipe them out? Like that's God's will. But fast forward, because of where supposedly, again, some of this is like pseudo history and pseudo geography, but supposedly because of where the descendants of Ham settled, which was Africa, that the descendants of Ham were dark-skinned people. And so race-based chattel slavery in America was justified by going back and saying, well, look, God cursed these people forever and ever. And so it's fine that we enslave them and treat them as property and trade them and do, horrific, unbelievably terrible things to them. It's actually God's, it was God's idea and God's cool with it. That is the lens of hierarchy. And it is, It's hard to like say which one of these is the most damaging or the most harmful. But I do think that the hierarchy lens, when you look back at 2,000 years of Christianity, is the one that has inflicted the most violence. Because it's the lens behind, it was the lens behind Nazi Germany. It was the justification for the Klan. It was the justification for race-based chattel slavery. Like I said, it was the justification for the Crusades and the murder of millions of Muslims. So it's hard to overstate just how not only prevalent this hierarchy lens is, but just how damaging and violent and harmful it really has been.
Yeah, thank you for that. There are so many layers to it, and these lenses are connected. So when you were talking about in the book, when you were writing about I don't remember if it was literalism or moralism, but we're going back to the doctrines in the 70s, where it's like, okay, this interpretation is the right one, probably inerrancy and some of the other statements there. And you talked about like, who were the people who wrote these statements and said, these are the ones? Okay, well, let's just name it, right? You do. They're like a whole bunch of white men, straight, most of them married, white, American, men, middle class or more, you know,
Politically
whatever,
conservative.
and politically conservative, all of the things. And then their interpretation ends up becoming the interpretation. And then when you
Correct.
look, it's like, okay, and then these are the people who have power. Another quote that lives in my head rent-free, Mark Charles, I have heard him say, when you hear about whatever, one of the ones is if you say women make such and such cents on the dollar, whatever it is now, to men. And his answer is, you shouldn't be surprised by that because the Constitution is working. It was written by white landowning men for white landowning men. And so when we see any of these things, especially in the US, we shouldn't be surprised, but we should just remember that the Constitution is working. And I think the same thing applies here. And so when we look at this like hierarchy, it's like, but it applies in so many things. But what is constant is that the hierarchy is working because it's you put like white, straight, landowning, essentially men who are politically conservative and powerful, who, as long as they're on top, like the hierarchy is working. So whether it's people of color, people with disabilities, people with sexual orientations that they don't recognize to be legitimate, whether it's women, whatever, even children, you know, it's like the hierarchy is working, to kind of paraphrase that, because they're on top and everyone else is just like, it doesn't really matter, but they're just like somewhere else down there. And you talk, I don't know that it was in this chapter, but you use the stories in Genesis to talk about that with women, which is something that I'm familiar with. I was having a conversation yesterday, and I'm like, man, it's rough in Texas. You know, I said last year when I graduated with my MDiv, I was like kind of casually looking. I was like, maybe I'll do like part-time church work, part-time pastoral, whatever. And I'm like, I am here to tell you that a woman with an MDiv is not qualified to pastor in Texas because I am not a married man, maybe with a high school diploma, you know, and no theological education. And I'm like, man, that sucks, you know, but like, there's nothing I can do about it. Like, I am never gonna be a white married man. I am a mixed Hispanic woman. You know, I'm like, I don't know what to do. I will never be a husband of but one wife, which is in the job descriptions, by the way, if you've ever read them. And, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know, back to the drawing board, I guess, you know, because the hierarchy says these men, these people must be in power, and everyone else kind of where they fall, it's not really that important, just as long as they're on the rungs of the ladder that are lower.
Below us,
Right. But, and so I would say we're accustomed to that. When I say the Constitution, I'm going to shut up after this, but the Constitution is working. That's one thing. But it's a different thing to say the Bible is working or our religion is working. That stings. That is
Absolutely.
problematic.
Absolutely. And I think you really hit the nail on the head. And I think we have to be asking when we encounter any kind of biblical interpretation or any kind of, institutional structures and things like that, who benefits? Who benefits from this interpretation? And if it is one group lording power over another group, then there's a really good indication that that's a bad interpretation, because that is so far from the heart of God and the way of Jesus, who was quick to elevate women, was quick to go to the margins, was quick to engage with people who'd been pushed outside of societal boundaries and things like that. Jesus went to those places. Carlos Rodriguez says one of my favorite quotes that lives in my head rent-free. He says, anytime we draw a line to exclude people, Jesus goes to the other side of the line and stands with them and invites us to join him there. And so when you're encountering a biblical interpretation, to stay on, directly with the book, if you're encountering a biblical interpretation, a great first question is, who does this benefit? And if the answer is not the flourishing of all people, then it's a bad interpretation. And that's why on the flip side, I use flourishing as one of the healthy lenses to actually engage with, to try to figure out if this is a good interpretation or not.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because I'm like, let's get to the fun stuff, I really, I really do. So the healing lenses, the lenses that promote healing, Jesus-centered context, flourishing, and fruitfulness, those are, gosh, I would say those are just beautiful, but those to me are among lenses that can help us maybe even kind of like change our hermeneutic from the box, from this kind of rigid box, to this more like, okay, what are, like, big picture, like, give me a big picture, what are we talking about here? I don't think it was in these chapters, but I think it was closer to the beginning of the book, maybe, where you tell a story about a made-up rabbit that you tell with your kids, and kind of like what is true. And so maybe I'll ask you to kind of tell us about that, because I think that's a good thing to kind of have in our heads as we talk about these lenses that promote healing, is like even that concept of truth, or what is true.
Well, you get an award because you're the first person that's asked me about Cuppy the Rabbit. And I've done a
Cuppy.
lot of
No, no
podcast
award. I
interviews.
didn't remember his name.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
No,
That's right.
you
Cuppy.
remember the story and you asked me about it. So yeah. I feel like my boys are gonna grow up and be like, I can't believe you told the whole world about Cuppy the Rabbit. But yeah,
Cuppy's famous.
he really is now. So yeah, it's this thing that I it started with, and this as a mom, right? Like your kids, especially when they're younger, you got to be ready with a story anytime, anywhere, like they could be in the car on the way somewhere. They might yell at you from the toilet, be like, tell me a story, and you got to be ready. And there was a time early on in parenthood where I was not ready. I was caught off guard all the time. I had no stories to tell. And so I just kind of like invented this rabbit and this like little world where we could all, like every story could be told inside of this. That's why I didn't have to like, come up with something new every single time. And so I tell them all these little stories about Cuppy the Rabbit, his adventures, and they usually involve him, getting into some mischief, into some trouble, and then, usually reconciling at the end. And I try to throw a little dad life lesson in there,
Of course.
And there is the story I tell in the book is that I told a Cuppy story one time about Cuppy, and he and his friends are playing soccer. Our family is like soccer obsessed, and so love that. And he's playing soccer, and this other rabbit comes and steals, or fox, I don't know, something. Some other animal comes and steals the soccer ball and runs away with the ball, and the whole rest of the adventure is them trying to get it back. And they finally get it back, and then Cuppy asks the animal that stole the ball's name is Maverick in the story, and asks Maverick, like, why did you steal the ball? And Maverick says, well, I didn't have anybody to play with, and I thought maybe if I took your ball that you guys would have to come play with me. And Cuppy is like, well, come play with us, we love, and it's a happily ever after kind of a story. So I tell him that story, and months later one of my kids comes home and he says, hey, something happened today at school, just like with Cuppy and Maverick. And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like Cuppy and Maverick,
That story was so gone, like the second you
yeah, it's
came out of
like,
my
come
mouth.
on. So, but he says, okay, we're on the playground, we're playing basketball, some kid steals our ball. It's a whole thing. Like he's being disruptive, whatever, he's getting in trouble. And my son is like, I remember the story. And so I asked him if he wanted to play with us. And the kid said, I would love, like, basically, like, yes, I want to come play. And he played and it was awesome, you know? And so the question I ask in the book is like, is the Cuppy and Maverick story true? Well, it's not like historical, you know? Like, I'm not
That we know of, I
that
mean.
we know of. Great point. I'm not that deeply involved in rabbit life to know. It
Right.
could be. But is it true in the sense that does it tell us something true about the world and how we should treat people and how a lot of people act out because they're hurt or scared or frustrated? Absolutely. And that Jesus was this masterful storyteller, you know, like Cuppy and Maverick, you know, I mean, he told parables more than any other teaching style. And so I think when we engage with scripture, not just the stories of Jesus, but more holistically, we should be asking, like, what's universally true about this? What was true then? What's true now? And so whether it's like the creation story in Genesis or the, you know, way we engage with Revelation or whatever it is, the biblical authors are so much less interested in like, this is the historical recounting of the creation of the earth. And here is all the science and the history and the facts, and more concerned with being like, God created all of this because he loves us and he wants to be with us, you know? And other gods that told, they st told stories about other creations at the time. And those gods created humans to, because they didn't want to work anymore and they wanted to kind of make humans their slaves and do all their work. But Yahweh, our God, actually created us to rule alongside and to be in deep relationship and to walk and talk and love and laugh. And like, gosh, what an incredible story. And I'm telling you, like, in that way, Genesis 1 through 3 and the Adam and Eve story in the Garden of Eden is as true as any story I've ever heard. And there is no part of me that thinks that is a factual retelling of the creation of the earth, but yet it is so, so true. And I think that applies broadly throughout the biblical text.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, because that was really meaningful to me. Those are some conversations that I have had with friends, especially who we were, been friends since young adulthood, grew up in some of the same spaces, were discipled in some of the same spaces. And when my questions started leading me to other theological places, that was one of the most common kind of places where we rubbed each other wrong. It was the kind of this abrasive little like, oh, I don't know, not in a mean way, but just kind of like, I don't get it. What about this? And it's like, but truth can mean something, different. And so, yeah, so I really appreciated that as an example of, of what is true and how this can be helpful and all of that. I do want to spend some time. I know we're running short, but I do want to spend some time on these lenses that promote healing because they felt very wonderful for me to read. I would say, especially, honestly, especially the flourishing and the fruitfulness ones. I think, when I think about when I think about justice, when I think about flourishing, when I think about some of the passages where, in the New Testament and the Gospels and some of John's writings, we talk about fruit. I'm like, gee whiz, this is so hard. But what is like, I don't know, I don't want to say universally true, but like when I'm looking at these big pictures, it's like, what does God really desire? For us and for our communities, for our for us and our neighbors. If you'll bear with me for 1 second, I'm like almost ready to do this, but there was a beautiful quote that you started. Well, all of I just want to say like all of the quote. What are these? I always forget what these are called. The quotes at the beginnings of the chapters. What are those called?
Oh, they have names? I don't know.
They do, and I always forget it. I always
Okay,
forget.
well, this
I
is
don't
new
know.
information. I would love
Okay,
to know if you
good.
figure it out.
I'm glad I'll think of it as soon as we hang up. Yeah, and then I'll email you and tell you.
Perfect.
But this is one by Barbara Brown Taylor, who's one of my favorites. But she said, the only clear line I draw these days is this: when my religion tries to come between me and my neighbor, I will choose my neighbor, Jesus never commanded me to love my religion. But I think this of like, what is kind of like, what is the point? Well, I don't know. You had one before that about love, right? Eugene Peterson's like, what is the point? I think the point is that we've got to like try to love each other well. And what does that look like? I think something that I've been wrestling with lately is like, going way back to the beginning of our conversation, like who's in and who's out, what's in this box? I'm like, gosh, I think even if I go back to that paradigm of like being wrong and right, I'm like, man, these days I just feel like if I'm gonna be wrong, I'd rather be wrong for like including people I'm not supposed to than like excluding people. that I'm, anyway. So that really spoke to me, especially in those two chapters. So maybe choose your own adventure. Pick one to start with. But why, I guess, like, why were those meaningful? And then give us like a little bit more than just the word, because when I got in, I was like, oh, this is what it means.
Yes, absolutely. I love those two lenses as well. It's not surprising either. I mean, you are a seminary trained theologian, and so a Jesus-centered lens, engaging with context. Hopefully those were still helpful chapters, but they're not new concepts to you, right? The other two, I think, are ones that they're also probably not new concepts, but I think my hope was that the way that we package them in the book would be actually like really deeply helpful, because the whole book is really pastoral. It comes out of my pastoring of people here in Austin and in some online spaces and things like that, and the questions that I get so much, which is essentially just like, what do I do with the Bible? But much more than that, what's most important? Like you just said, like what's the point? What are we actually supposed to be doing? And if we are people who are Christians, which means little Christs, then the point is really to look like Jesus, to act like Jesus, to follow Jesus. And Jesus was actually incredibly clear about what was most important to him. He got asked, what's the most important thing in the world? And he said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. And when he got pushed back about like, well, who really is my neighbor? He's basically like, well, let me tell you a story about the person that you revile the most, the person that's the most different from you. That's your neighbor. That's the person you are responsible to. But then we also have these pretty incredible times when Jesus gives us what I would call like mission statements. So one happens in Luke 4 when he preaches his first public sermon in his hometown synagogue. And he says, he reads that passage from Isaiah and says, I've come to, bring good news to the poor and set the captives free and declare the year of God's favor and all that stuff. Then the second one, kind of I think the even more compact and thus powerful one is John 10:10. I came to bring life and life abundantly. I came to help people flourish. That's what God's desire is for everybody to flourish. And that, if that's Jesus's mission statement, if that was the why he came, I came so that people might experience life to the full, life abundantly, then goodness, shouldn't our biblical interpretation be leading to flourishing? Right? If it's the thing that Jesus came to do, and our Bible interpretation is either not leading to that, or God forbid, getting in the way of people's flourishing, then my goodness, we should be reconsidering those interpretations, and so that's the flourishing one. I talk a lot about liberation theology in it, which is such a gift from the kind of South American, Central American church, and then up into the Black Church of the United States. Liberation being kind of whatever gets in the way of our flourishing. Liberation is the removal, the freeing from that, so that we can step into flourishing. Then the last one is fruitfulness, that last lens. And this is probably the one that I talk about the most, just kind of day in, day out pastoring, because Jesus said, you'll know my followers by their fruit. If you want to know if someone's following me, look at the fruit that their lives produce. And then he says, I'm leaving, but it's actually better for you that I'm leaving, because I'm going to send my spirit. And it's not just I'm going to be next to you, I'm going to be within you through my spirit. Right. And so then a little bit later on in Galatians, right, Paul says, the fruit that Jesus was talking about, the fruit of Jesus' spirit within you is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. So when Jesus said, "You'll know my followers by their fruit," he's saying we should be people known for love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, etc. And so when we're doing biblical interpretation, we should be asking every single time, does this interpretation lead to more love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, etc. in me and in the world around me? And if not, we should absolutely reconsider that interpretation because it's not the fruit of human intelligence. It's not the fruit of our hard work. It's not the fruit of checking all the right doctrinal boxes. It is the fruit of Jesus's spirit at work in and through us. And if that's what we're supposed to be doing, then shouldn't our Bible interpretations lead to that too? And all the way down to our beliefs and behaviors and all of that, we should be constantly asking. Like I tell our people, at the end of the day, you lay your head on your pillow and you say, "Was I a part of helping people experience more love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, etc. today?" And if no, then go to sleep and wake up and try again the next day. Don't live in shame and condemnation and all that stuff. Because like you said, I think most of us are trying the best we can. But in a world where so many of us are just constantly asking, "Am I doing it right? Am I doing enough? Am I, doing what God wants me to do?" I think there's no more practical check than to say, "Am I making sure that as much love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, etc. is happening in me and through me?" I don't think there's any better check than that. And it's also just to not put too fine a point on it. There's absolutely a reason that love is the first one mentioned. And there's a reason that Jesus talked about love more than any of those other ones put together. I mean, that is the central aspect of all of it. It's where peace and joy and kindness and self-control, it all flows from love.
Yeah. Gosh, Zach, you're right. Thank you so much. I'm just like I'm really grateful for this book. Some of it you said some of it wasn't new. Some of it wasn't new because I feel like I grew up in the church next door, you know? I mean that was a lot of it for me. And so this felt like a really personal book. And it also was just But it was just also very encouraging,
Oh, good.
because I just thought I there's we are all out there trying to do the best we can with what we have, and I think that looking at the Bible in this way, as a tool of healing, even that in and of itself feels healing.
Yes, totally.
That feels something where I can open this book up, one that, for me and for you and people who grew up maybe with, we don't talk about Bible drills and stuff like that, but it's like very familiar, to us from
Yeah.
having to memorize where the Beatitudes, back in the day. But even for people for whom it's not as familiar, to open it up and see it as something that came to us by a God who cares about our flourishing, who cares about our fruitfulness, who comes to us with gentleness and those
Yes,
other fruit of the
yes.
Spirit that you named, and wants us to experience God in that way,
Yeah.
that feels really amazing. So, anyway, thank you so much. I realize we're like past time, but again, like I said, part two, you're always welcome. Let me say the name of the book one more time, and of course, there'll be a link in the show notes where people can grab it. It's called Better Ways to Read the Bible: Transforming a Weapon of Harm into a Tool of Healing by Zach Lambert. Thank you so much, Zach, for being with me.
Thanks. Oh, thanks for having me, Alexis, and thanks for saying that at the end. I want more than anything else for people to have that exact experience that you just described, and so I'm so glad that was true for you, and I hope it's true for lots of folks.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.